So as we continue in this new series in 1 Peter, our text this morning is 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 to 9. 1 Peter, like so much of the New Testament, is full of the future, and I mean by that the ultimate future. It's continually drawing our attention to the end of time, the end of the world, the end of all things, as Peter himself puts it in chapter 4, verse 7. And if I were to sum up in one line what exactly it is about the end that Peter wants us to look forward to, this would be my line: seeing and sharing in the resurrection glory of Jesus Christ. As the apostle keeps pointing us in this letter to the last day, that, above all else, is what he associates with the last day. Then, on that day, we shall see and share in the resurrection glory of Jesus Christ. Let me show you quickly then some of the relevant texts. So just to establish, first of all, that Christ has this resurrection glory, as I'm calling it, look at chapter 1, verse 21. And in the middle of that verse, Peter says, God raised him from the dead and gave him glory. So that makes it very plain then that, for one thing, the body of Jesus Christ, brutally murdered on Good Friday, is no longer that corpse which Joseph of Arimathea lovingly laid in a quiet garden tomb. It has been resurrected. And for another thing, that body doesn't now exist in the same condition as when Jesus was a carpenter in Nazareth, or when he was a traveling teacher in Galilee and Judea. It has been made glorious. So that verse, as I say, establishes that Christ has resurrection glory. But as for us one day seeing that resurrection glory of Christ, it's interesting that Peter uses very visual words in this letter to describe the end. He doesn't, in this letter at least, use that word that Paul likes so much, the word parousia, coming, as our English versions usually translate it. He doesn't portray the end as the coming of Christ. Rather, his favourite word is revelation. On that day, Christ is going to be revealed. Chapter 1, verse 7, the revelation of Jesus Christ. Chapter 1, verse 13, again, the revelation of Jesus Christ. Chapter 4, verse 13, when his glory is revealed. Chapter 5, verse 1, the glory that is going to be revealed. He also, in chapter 5, verse 4, uses a similarly visual word, appears, when the chief shepherd appears, he says. The whole significance of something being revealed is that you can see it. And so Christ's resurrection glory being revealed on that great day means us seeing Christ's resurrection glory on that day. So that's the seeing part. As for us sharing in the resurrection glory of Christ, chapter 5, verse 4 refers to us receiving, when Christ appears, an unfading crown of glory. But the most explicit text is chapter 5, verse 1, which talks about being a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed. So I'm saying then that this is the future prospect which dominates 1 Peter and which dominates our passage this morning. The inheritance to which Peter refers in verse 4 of our passage, this inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, he means there the resurrection glory of Christ that we are one day going to see and share in. Imperishable is a very resurrection-associated word in the New Testament. 5 times in 1 Corinthians 15, it's used in connection with resurrection. Peter here is using it then of Christ's glorious resurrection body. The other two words he uses there apply equally well to it: undefiled, unfading. And then there's that phrase, kept in heaven. That's where Christ's glorious resurrection body is now. It's a bit reminiscent, isn't it, of Peter's language when addressing the crowds outside the temple in chapter 3 of Acts. In verse 21 there, he says that heaven must receive Christ. That is to say, it must keep him there until the time for restoring all things. So Christ's resurrection glory is the inheritance of verse 4, and us seeing that glory and sharing in that glory. That's the hope to which Peter is referring in verse 3. He calls it there, doesn't he, a living hope. That's a striking phrase, isn't it? This is not just a hope on paper, in other words. It's not just a hope that exists in theology books. It's not just a hope that's in creeds. But rather, it's a living hope. It's a hope that's meant to be alive and pulsating away in our hearts all the time, every day. Not just on a Sunday, but on a Wednesday, on a Friday, every day. This hope of one day seeing and sharing in the resurrection glory of Christ. Let me ask you, is that a living hope to you? Is that a living hope to you this morning? Is that something that you're actually meaningfully looking forward to? Does it excite you? I mean, think about it. Think about seeing Christ's resurrection glory. I remember once hearing Jeff Thomas talk about a speed camera. I can't remember now what the point was that he was making, but this speed camera, he said it was on some road in West Wales. And the scenery then on either side of that road is absolutely delightful. Lovely green hills dotted with sheep and interspersed with patches of purple heather. And yet, Jeff said, that fancy, expensive, high-tech camera, it never takes any pictures of the scenery, just car number plates. Day in, day out, every time it flashes, it's photographing another stupid car number plate. And these eyes of ours, they were designed to gaze upon the glory of Jesus Christ, not the screen of a smartphone, not endless, mindless TikTok videos, not people pouting their lips for photos on Instagram. That's like that high-tech speed camera focusing only on number plates. But imagine if the speed camera one day twists on its stand. Imagine if it turns away from the cars whizzing past it and it starts capturing the hills and the sheep and the heather. Well, that's what's going to happen one day to these eyes of ours. They're going to one day be transfixed and enthralled and mesmerized by the resurrection glory of Christ. But then on top of seeing that glory, sharing in it. Sharing in it. Imagine going to the National Art Gallery and there's some masterpiece there which particularly captivates you. And you stand in front of it for about an hour, utterly transported by its beauty. And as you stand there, others come and stand there near you, also enjoying this work of art. But after a while, something strange starts to happen. You notice that the other people milling around, they aren't just looking at the work of art and gasping and pointing at it, as you'd expect. They're also looking at you and gasping and pointing. Because remarkably, you're becoming like this painting that you've been gazing at all that time. Somehow its beauty is kind of seeping into you. You're becoming of a piece with this stunning creation that's hanging there on the wall. Now, of course, that's a ridiculous scenario, isn't it? It couldn't possibly happen. But that's what's going to happen on the day that we see the resurrection glory of Christ. We're not going to be detached observers merely. We're going to get caught up in the glory that we're gazing at. It's going to rub off on us and seep into us so that we become replicas of the glorious resurrected Christ. Christian, I'm saying, this is your future. Seeing and sharing in the resurrection glory of Christ. Don't let your job be a bigger deal to you than this grand future of yours. Don't let those upcoming exams be a bigger deal than this future of yours. Don't let your fitness regime be a bigger deal than this future of yours. Make sure that seeing and sharing in Christ's resurrection glory truly is for you a living hope, a vibrant, dynamic, energetic, living hope. But this business then of the glorious risen Christ being kept in heaven and then revealed on that great last day, it all comes with a flip side, which is this. He's presently invisible to us, completely out of our sight. So that for the time being, instead of seeing him and gazing upon his resurrection glory, we must do something else. We must believe. We must believe in the glorious resurrected Christ kept for now in heaven. We must exercise faith. And for the remainder of our time this morning, it's that faith which until the end transpires, until we receive our inheritance, seeing and sharing in the resurrection glory of Christ, that faith which until then you and I must exercise, it's that that we're going to dwell on. And just notice with me then, if you will, three things. First of all, guarded faith. Guarded faith. Perhaps in the last few minutes, this sermon has been a bit of a roller coaster ride for you. Perhaps you enjoyed me pointing to your exciting future. I very much hope indeed that you did. But perhaps your heart then sank when I spoke just now about the need to exercise faith for the time being. Perhaps that second emphasis filled your soul with anxious thoughts, because the reality is, it's hard to believe. Hard to believe in the glorious resurrected Christ located in heaven when we can't see him. There's an intrinsic hardness about that whole thing. And then that intrinsic hardness is compounded by the mockery and the contempt of people around us who think we're such fools for exercising this faith. And perhaps then you're sitting here this morning wondering, can I really keep up this faith? This faith that's so indispensable as long as sight is withheld from us. Can I manage it? Can I do it? Is it feasible? Is it sustainable? Perhaps such misgivings are swirling around your head. Well, in this regard, verses 3 to 5 of our passage are wonderfully encouraging, because verses 3 to 5 don't present our faith as this terrible liability, the weak link, as it were, that might well fail and scupper everything so that we end up missing out on our inheritance after all. They don't present our faith as a kind of accident waiting to happen, not in the least. For one thing, there's that emphasis in verse 3 on God having given us new birth. And verse 3 really needs to be read in conjunction with a later verse in this chapter, verse 23. Where Peter elaborates on this new birth that God has given us, and he says this: you have been born again, not of perishable seed, but of imperishable. And he's contrasting there this new birth from God with ordinary human procreation. Ordinary human procreation involves perishable seed, he says. As one commentator puts it, the human sperm of a father is perishable and earthly. Even if it produces children, they will die eventually. So you get the point then, that in ordinary human procreation, there's this perishable seed that's involved, that inevitably produces mortal life, impermanent life, life that won't last. That's why everyone dies. The new birth from God, on the other hand, it involves this imperishable seed, this imperishable sperm, which Peter equates with the word of God. And it, therefore, produces unending life. That is to say, there's no such thing as a perishable born-again person. A person who lives a born-again life for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and then stops doing so because his or her faith fails. That doesn't happen. It can't happen. God doesn't beget short-lived children. He begets indestructible children, every single one of whom remains alive and well and goes on, therefore, to receive the inheritance. We can put it like this. If your faith were to fail, if it were to utterly disintegrate and disappear without trace, then God would have made a mess of your new birth. He would have done no better than a human father. He'd have given birth to something fleeting and temporary. And that's unthinkable. And so I'm saying that emphasis there in verse 3 on new birth, it encourages us, doesn't it, vis-a-vis our faith. But then for another thing, there's that emphasis in verse 5 on God's protection of us. We are being protected, that verse says, for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. There you have that word revealed again, don't you? And the same thing is in view as on the other occasions when revelation language is used in this epistle, i.e. the revelation of Christ's resurrection glory. Why then does it say here salvation rather than Christ is going to be revealed? Well, simply because it amounts to the same thing. Seeing and sharing in the resurrection of glory of Christ, that will be salvation for us. That will be salvation. But the verse really goes to town on this protection that we enjoy until then. Who, he says, by God's power are being guarded. Power is a strong noun, and being guarded is a strong verb. When we took Isaac up to Glasgow in September, we encountered on the motorway the most enormous convoy. It must have been a couple of miles in length, comprising tens of vehicles, some of them police, some of them military. I don't know what it was that was being transported up the M74 that day, whether it was unusually dangerous prisoners or unusually special VIPs or unusually extreme weapons, I don't know. But whatever it was being very carefully protected. That convoy meant business. It wasn't taking any chances. Maximum security was the name of the game. And that's the picture in verse 5 here. Who by God's power are being guarded. We're meant to think of serious, maximum security in operation here. But notice that in the midst of all that, a little phrase is thrown in, through faith. Through faith. Who by God's power are being guarded through faith. Now, if our faith is this hopeless weak point that could easily fail, jeopardizing our inheritance, that makes a nonsense, doesn't it, of all this stuff about God's power guarding us. Of what use is God's power guarding us if our faith could end up just ruining everything? No, surely the point must be that God's powerful guarding overrides and renders irrelevant the weakness of our faith. Think of it this way. Suppose that right at the heart of that convoy on the M74 was a little mini. I mean, one of the old-fashioned minis, like what Mr. Bean used to drive, the flimsiest little car that you can think of. And suppose then those dangerous prisoners, or those special VIPs, whoever it was that was on that road that day, suppose they were there in that mini. No blacked-out windows, no bulletproof doors, no reinforced glass. It wouldn't matter, would it? It wouldn't matter because all those police vans and all those military trucks were surrounding it. By itself, that little mini, of course, would be hopelessly inadequate. But in the context of that massive, invincible convoy, the mini's inadequacies wouldn't be an issue. The convoy would ensure that the mini made it. And similarly, God's powerful guarding will ensure that our faith, flimsy though it is by itself, makes it. So don't worry that it won't make it, believer. Don't be a gloomy Eeyore ruling yourself out of your inheritance, ruling yourself out of seeing and sharing in the resurrection glory of Christ because you just can't envisage your faith lasting the course. Rather, be of good cheer. Yes, viewed by itself, your faith might appear a terribly insubstantial, temperamental, breakable thing. But you need to step back and view your faith in a wider context, in the context of that supernatural, irreversible new birth you've experienced, and in the context of God's almighty, unassailable protecting of you. View your faith in that wider context. And then you'll see all the deficiencies and all the flaws of your faith in perspective. And you'll be encouraged. And you'll find yourself able to sing those words with Top Lady, "Yes, I to the end shall endure. I shall endure." Guarded faith. Secondly, genuine faith. Genuine faith. This point that I've just been making, that our faith won't fail, that because we've been born again and because we have God's power committed to our protection, our faith will persist. It will keep going all the way. That is something which from time to time God graciously proves to us. In verse 7, Peter talks about gold. So imagine you live in the first century AD. And you have tucked away in a secret corner of your house some gold. And you know that one day you're going to need that gold. There's no such thing in your world as a state pension. When you're old and no longer able to earn a wage, that gold will carry you through. But sometimes you endure sleepless nights worrying about that gold. Not worrying that it's going to get stolen. You're pretty confident it's well enough hidden to prevent that. But worrying that it's not actually genuine gold. That it's some other much less valuable substance that will leave you high and dry on the day that you need to tap into your gold reserves. However, there's a way of ending your sleepless nights. There's something you can do. You can get a nice hot fire going. And you can pass your gold through that fire. And if your gold survives the flames, then you know it's genuine. You know that that gold won't fail you on the day that you need it. You can sleep in peace. And that then is the kind of scenario Peter's envisaging in verse 7. And his point is this. If that's a wonderful thing, if it's a wonderful thing to have the genuineness of your gold proven to you, if that gives you peace of mind, then it's an even more wonderful thing to have the genuineness of your faith proven to you. Because your faith, he says, is more precious than your gold is. Your gold, he says, perishes. That is to say, it's a temporal thing. It has a bearing on your welfare in this short life, and that's all. Your faith, on the other hand, it has a bearing on your eternal welfare. It has a bearing on you receiving that inheritance mentioned in verse 4. And so if its genuineness is proven to you, then you really can enjoy sleepless nights. Enjoy peaceful nights, rather. And as I said a moment ago, God sometimes does graciously give us that proof. How does he then? How does he? If surviving fire proves the genuineness of gold, what proves the genuineness of faith? Well, the answer, according to Peter, is surviving trials. Trials do for genuine faith what fire does for genuine gold. Now, Peter's not being weird here. He's not saying trials, therefore, are fantastic things. No, he refers in verse 6 to being grieved by various trials. Peter is frank that trials are grievous. They are painful and traumatic and deeply unpleasant. He's not for one moment saying, enjoy trials, folks. Go looking for trials and don't let me catch you crying or groaning or sighing when you're experiencing a trial. Of course he's not saying that. But he is saying that when you've been through something really hard, perhaps a bereavement, perhaps a spouse being unfaithful to you, perhaps a campaign by someone to destroy your reputation, perhaps the loss of many of your possessions in some calamity, when you've been through something like that, and at the end of it all, though you're scarred and bruised and hobbling, you haven't given up on Christ. And you can't give up on Christ. You're still drawn to him with a kind of gravitational pull. There's still this thread of faith emerging from your heart and fastening on him. That, Peter is saying, that is proof that your faith ain't going to fail. Because if it were going to fail, it would have failed then in that trial. And the fact that it hasn't, that demonstrates that it's genuine faith that will go all the way. And it will result in the language of verse 7, in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. That is you receiving praise at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Well done, good and faithful servant. That is you receiving glory, this favorite concept of Peter's throughout the letter, sharing in the glory of Jesus Christ. And you receiving honor as you share in the glory of Jesus Christ. God, through the trial, is reassuring you that you have a faith that will last the course and that you will therefore eventually claim your inheritance. Sometimes we come away from certain experiences knowing things about ourselves. So in order to raise money, perhaps for a particular cause, you do some sponsored mountain climbing in Scotland. And it involves scaling with ropes the famous inaccessible pinnacle on the island of Skye. And having stood then on top of that precarious rock formation, 985 meters above sea level, enjoying the view and feeling utterly exhilarated, you come away from that knowing that you have a head for heights. One day at work, the boss suddenly takes ill. And you're asked to take her place in a crucial meeting with a massive potential client where a multi-million pound deal is at stake. And having risen to the occasion then, and having competently chaired that meeting, exuding ruthlessness and charm in equal measure, getting the deal over the line, you come away from that knowing that you have a coolness under pressure. We come away, I'm saying, from certain experiences knowing things about ourselves. And perhaps for you then, this has been a tough year. Perhaps it's been a tough couple of years, or a tough few decades even. But as you're here this morning, at this worship service that's all about Jesus, because you still believe in him, and you still cling to him, and you still lean on him, and you still want him, you know something about yourself. You know that that faith that you have in him is a real thing. You know that you're truly a born-again person, guarded by God's power and possessing a faith that isn't going to unravel suddenly one day. The fact that you're still a living, breathing, functioning believer in Jesus Christ after all that you've been through, that, I'm saying, is evidence. That is proof. That is verification. And yes, of course, you'd have loved an easier year, or couple of years, or however long it's been. And that's entirely understandable. But I'm saying to you that that knowledge of yourself that you now have, that's not something to be sniffed at. It's a valuable self-knowledge. It's a self-knowledge that is worth having. It's a self-knowledge which God has graciously given you through the trial that you've painfully passed through. So guarded faith, genuine faith, but then thirdly, gateway faith. Gateway faith. So I said in the introduction then that we're looking forward to the revelation of Jesus Christ, to seeing his resurrection glory. And at the flip side of that is that our glorious Christ is presently invisible to us, meaning that for the time being, we must simply believe in him. And all of that's true then, but I now want to qualify it a little. Because it becomes clear in verses 8 and 9 that the situation is not on that day we're going to see and share in Christ's resurrection glory, and until then, we don't really experience anything of Christ at all. We just exercise faith. And he's kept in heaven and we're here on earth. And our faith is this very, 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 very long thread or wire that keeps us attached to him. But it's all very drab and colourless and insipid until that day of revelation. And only then will anything really happen. No, it's more nuanced than that. Look at those verses 8 and 9. And the first half of verse 8 sounds a bit like what I've just described. It sounds as though that is the case. Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him. It sounds like faith is just this very poor substitute for the sight that we're eventually going to enjoy. That's the feel of the first half of the verse. But then suddenly the tone changes. Look at verse 9 first, where he says, so if you go back to the middle of verse 8, you believe in him, verse 9, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls, obtaining, present tense. But the outcome of our faith is seeing Jesus Christ. That's its goal. That's salvation, seeing Jesus Christ, and that's only going to happen at the end. So how can we be already obtaining the outcome of our faith? Well, this is the point Peter's making. Our faith is not a bare stopgap to kind of span the time until we properly experience Jesus Christ at the end. I read an article the other day where the headline was Rishi Sunak, the stopgap prime minister, and the point it was making was that, you know, Boris Johnson was elected as prime minister, and then of course he had to stand down, and then we had Liz Truss for a very brief period, and then Rishi Sunak just came as a kind of stopgap to get us through to the election, and that was it. And Peter is saying here in these verses, our faith is not just a kind of stopgap to kind of get us through to the end when we'll properly start to experience Jesus Christ. No, our faith enables us to experience Jesus Christ now, Peter says here. Not to the full extent, that's true, not to the full extent that we'll experience him at the end, because truly we don't yet see him, as we've been saying, and we don't yet share in his resurrection glory. But nonetheless, in a real sense, we experience Jesus Christ now by our faith. We enjoy now his presence and his loveliness, so much so that verse 8 says that we rejoice. And again, it's talking about now. We rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. Glory language again. It's only going to be at the end, of course, that we properly share in Christ's glory. That's when our bodies will shine with glory. But already there's some glory spills into our joy, this verse is saying, because already we experience something of Jesus Christ. In the language of chapter 2, verse 3 of this letter, we already taste him and his goodness, or his delightfulness would perhaps be a better translation of that verse. And this is what I mean then by gateway faith. We use that word sometimes, don't we? Holding. We talk about a holding page on a website that's not yet ready to go live, and so it has a holding page. Or we talk about a holding email. So you've received an email, but you're presently too busy to reply to it. And so you just send back a holding email indicating that you soon will reply. And it kind of buys you a bit of time, but it doesn't actually progress the conversation at all. Our faith is not a holding faith. It's not just kind of keeping everything static and not progressing anything until Christ appears. And then at last our relationship with Christ will be activated. No, it's a gateway faith by which we enter now already into a rich and satisfying relationship with Christ. Sterling advertises itself as the gateway to the Highlands. And our faith then is the gateway into the relationship, a relationship with Jesus Christ. And yes, it's only a gateway. Just as Stirling is only a gateway. You're not yet in the Cairngorms or Torridon or wherever. But you are already by faith in a proper, genuine, meaningful relationship with Christ. Its full flowering will only be when Christ appears. And when faith turns to sight. And when we see his glory and share in his glory. But already believing in Jesus, you begin to enter prematurely into the pleasures of the future. You begin to have a foretaste in advance of the delights of the age to come. And so My point is, Christian, don't wait for the end to engage deeply with Jesus Christ. Don't say, oh, well, in the light of everything that we've seen in this passage this morning, then let's just sit back and forget about Christ and wait for him to return, and then we'll have a relationship with him. Then we'll see him. Then we'll share in his glory. No, our faith is a gateway faith. It takes us into a relationship with Christ now. Not the full thing yet. That's true, and that's important. But it takes us into a real relationship with Christ now. And so pursue that relationship. Cultivate that relationship. Dig deep into that relationship. Know something not yet of Christ's glory flooding your body, because that's impossible in this present age. But know something of Christ's glory flooding your joy. Know something of Christ's glory flooding your emotions, your soul. Pursue Christ now, because by this faith of yours, you are obtaining, present tense, the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your soul. Amen.